Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. In this episode, I'm going to preview a case called Currier v. Virginia, which is going to be argued on Tuesday, February 20th, 2018. Now, Currier v. Virginia is a case about double jeopardy, the double jeopardy clause of the Fifth Amendment, and specifically the application of double jeopardy to severed criminal trials. And by this, I mean when a criminal defendant is tried in multiple trials on different charges arising from the same events. So just as a bit of background, the Fifth Amendment, one of the protections in the Fifth Amendment is that no person shall be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb. And the courts have found that there are two different types of protections provided by the double jeopardy clause. The most obvious one is that a person just can't be tried multiple times for the same offense. The government can't try someone for some crime, say someone's charged with murder, and the jury acquits the person, and then the government can't come around and just try them again for that same crime. And when dealing with this kind of core double jeopardy right, the court looks at the formal elements of the offense and sees, is this the same crime essentially that's being charged in both trials? But there's a separate protection under the double jeopardy clause that's referred to by the name issue preclusion. And the basic idea here is that the government in prosecuting someone is precluded, it's prevented from retrying an issue that was already decided against the government by a jury. And I'll explain that a little more in a moment. But basically, under the issue preclusion type of double jeopardy protection, courts will look at the actual arguments that were made at a previous trial to decide if the government is precluded from trying to make certain arguments in a subsequent trial. And this idea, the issue preclusion, it comes out of a Supreme Court case called Ash v. Swenson from 1970. And here's the basic facts of that case. There was an armed robbery of six men at a private poker game. And one of the people charged with these robberies was a man named Ash. And he was tried for the robbery, not of all six men, but only of one of the men at this poker game that was robbed at this poker game. He was acquitted at trial, and the main issue raised at the trial was the witness identification. There were questions as to whether he had been accurately identified as one of the robbers, and he was acquitted. But importantly, there was no dispute that the robbery had actually occurred, or that all six of the victims of that robbery had been robbed at it. Now, what happened is later, after the acquittal on at the trial for the robbery of one of the six men at the poker game, the government came back and tried to try Ash for the robbery of a second man at the poker game. This ended up going all the way up to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court said that basically this violated double jeopardy, not because they were trying him for the same crime multiple times, but because in acquitting him for the first robbery, the jury had necessarily decided that the government had failed to prove that he was involved in this robbery. There was no way to say that he was not involved in the robbery of the first man, but was involved in the robberies of the others. So his acquittal in the first case necessarily required that he could not be tried in the later cases, because that issue, was he one of the robbers who was present there and participating in the robbery? That issue had already been decided against the government. So the government can't do an end run around the double jeopardy protection by charging trying slightly different charges if the same basic facts are required to convict on all of them. Now, that brings us to this case, the Currier v. Virginia. And this case involves a 2012 theft from a home of a safe. And that safe contained 20 guns and also $71,000 in cash. Now, the safe was later recovered with all 20 guns still inside, but the cash was gone. Michael Currier was charged, and he was charged with breaking and entering, with grand larceny. And he was also charged with possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. So a felon in possession charge. And a theory was behind this felon in possession charge was that the participants in this theft of the safe had handled those guns in the process of opening the safe and taking out all the cash. And that was the basis for the felon in possession charge. Now, importantly, Currier had prior felony convictions for breaking and entering and grand larceny. Now, these type of prior convictions are considered by courts to be highly prejudicial. They're the type of thing that, you know, if a jury hears that someone has been convicted of serious crimes in the past, and especially if those crimes are similar to the crimes that are being tried by the jury, juries will be likely just to convict, just to think, well, this is a criminal person, and not to worry too much about whether they're actually being correctly prosecuted in this particular instance or whether the government meets its burden, but to just convict on the basis of deciding that they're guilt based on their past convictions. So this type of information about prior convictions is usually not admissible. It's usually kept out of court because it's too prejudicial to the defendant and prevents the defendant from getting a fair trial. However, when there's a charge that requires as one of the elements of the charge that someone has been convicted of a previous felony, and that's true with this, the felon in possession of a firearm charge, it's a necessary element. So the government is allowed to and actually has to, in order to prove that crime, has to show evidence that the person has been convicted of a previous felony. Now, the issue here is how do you deal with the prejudicial nature of this prior conviction if it's necessary to introduce it for one of the charges? Well, one way to do it, and this is a way that is provided under Virginia law, was to sever the felon in possession charge from the other charges for purposes of trial. So the idea is you'd have two separate trials. One trial would only be on the breaking and entering and grand larceny, and in that trial, the government would not be able to enter evidence of the prior conviction. The second trial would be solely on the felon in possession charge, and in that trial, the government would be able to enter that information because it's necessary for purposes of conviction and the felon in possession charge. Now, what happened is Currier was tried first on the breaking and entering and grand larceny charges. And at that trial, he was acquitted on both charges. So the jury found him not guilty of the breaking and entering and grand larceny. The state went ahead with the second trial on the felon in possession charge. And in that trial, he was tried and convicted and sentenced to 5 years in prison for that. Now, Currier says basically this case is just like Ashby Swenson. The only theory that the government presented for the felon in possession charge was the possession of the guns in the process of committing the breaking and entering and robbery. The jury already acquitted him, necessarily found that he was not guilty or that the government had failed to prove the breaking and entering and robbery. So that should preclude him from being retried on the felon in possession charge. So that's the basic idea. That's Currier's basic argument under this issue preclusion theory of double jeopardy. Now, Virginia counters, and they say that the real purpose of the double jeopardy clause and the purpose of issue preclusion is to prevent the government from oppressing someone, from kind of abusing their ability to bring multiple prosecutions in order to have multiple tries at convicting someone. And here they say that wasn't the government's motive. The government, by severing the charges and giving him two trials, the government was actually protecting Currier's rights. The government was protecting him from having this prejudicial information about his prior conviction from being introduced in his trial on the breaking and entering and theft charges, larceny charges. So they say the government didn't have this impermissible motive. The government wasn't trying to abuse its ability to bring multiple prosecutions. So therefore there's no double jeopardy. Yeah. The issue preclusion shouldn't apply because there's no need to protect the rights. They also go on to argue that the severance, it was necessary under Virginia law for the defendant, Currier, he had to consent to the severance of the charges into two separate trials. He consented to that. And the government says that by doing that, by consenting to have two separate trials, he was waiving his right to later invoke double jeopardy to prevent the second trial from going forward. And they say he had a meaningful choice. He could have gone forward in a single trial, and then he wouldn't have to worry. It was a single trial where he would either be, you know, acquitted or convicted. But by choosing to have two separate trials, then he was waiving his right to later challenge that. The government also makes another kind of side argument where they say that it's possible that issue preclusion shouldn't even bar the second charge. Even if issue preclusion does apply, it's possible for him to have possessed the guns, even if he wasn't involved in the breaking and entering and the larceny. It's questionable whether the state there, Virginia, doesn't seem to be relying heavily on the argument, and it's questionable whether the court will even want to get into that kind of a factual detail. There's also an argument on Virginia's side by a number of other states who filed an amicus brief, and they point out, they said that Virginia didn't have to provide the severance of the two trials, and not every state does that. They could have used other methods to try and lessen the prejudice from the introduction of information about his prior convictions. And they didn't have to allow him to have those things severed in a separate trial. And they argue that allowing him to invoke double jeopardy protections would have the effect of disincentivizing states from severing in the future. It would kind of provide it would motivate states to not want to sever, because then they lose part of their ability to try some of these charges. Currier makes a few other arguments against Virginia. One of his arguments is just that the right against multiple trials, the right against being tried multiple times, the core double jeopardy right, is a very separate issue from issue preclusion, from this being protected by the acquittal on a specific issue that the jury necessarily considered. And he argues that that to waive one right, or to agree to have multiple trials, and also the case law that exists there. So there's case law in certain circumstances where defendants have voluntarily agreed to be tried in multiple trials, or multiple trials for charges that would otherwise be prevented under double jeopardy. When a defendants have voluntarily agreed to have them, they're tried in multiple trials, and the courts have said by doing that, they waive their right to invoke double jeopardy. And Currier argues that's the separate trial right is just not the same thing as the issue preclusion, and so those cases are not really applicable. And here he says while he did consent to the separate trials, his agreement to have separate trials on the different charges was forced by the government's intention to introduce the prejudicial evidence of his prior convictions. And so he argues that he shouldn't be forced to choose between his right to having a fair trial untainted by this prejudicial evidence and his right to only be tried once on the particular issues. He also argues that the government isn't really prejudiced here, because the particular issue in question, whether Currier was involved in this theft of the safe, the government had one full and fair opportunity to litigate that particular issue. They litigated that in the first trial on the breaking and entering and larceny charges. Had they succeeded and won in that trial, they could have gone on and still tried him on the felon in possession charge. But having lost that issue, they have no claim that they've been somehow denied their ability to prosecute him. They already had an opportunity to push forward on that particular issue. He also argues that issue preclusion is important because it protects the integrity of an acquittal, that in American law, the acquittals are kind of they're sacrosanct. When even in circumstances, for example, where a judge mistakenly dismisses a charge, thinking that it must be dismissed due to insufficiency of the indictment or something like that, but the judge is mistaken, that acquittal will still be binding and can't be later overturned. And also, he argues that this gives proper respect for the role of the jury. The jury heard his case, and a jury of his peers decided that he was not guilty of the crime charged, and the government should not be allowed to have a second shot at that to overturn the jury's judgment on that. And he also argues that issue preclusion is relatively narrow. It doesn't necessarily bar all second prosecutions arising out of the same incident. It's only when the factual theory behind the different charges necessarily overlaps to such a degree that acquittal on one charge means that the other one could not be proven without contradicting that acquittal. So that's the basic issues at play here, and so the Supreme Court will have to decide kind of the contours of issue preclusion and you know whether it's waived in certain circumstances. So that'll be coming up on February 20th, and a decision will come down sometime by the end of June this year. And that's it for this episode. Please subscribe to Counting to Five on YouTube or your audio podcast app of choice. And for timely coverage of the latest developments at the court, please check out Counting to Five's weekly YouTube live streams, where you can ask your own questions in the live chat. And we're currently broadcasting Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern time, but check the Counting to Five YouTube channel for the next scheduled live stream. I'm always looking for feedback. Please leave a comment or send me an email at mike@countingto5.com. And thank you for listening. This has been Counting to Five.